Most of you are aware, we have brought in a youth pastor candidate who has been with us this weekend, and so we have Chris and Paige Secor who are here, and I have invited Chris to come up and share a little bit about his call to ministry and his heart for ministry. So Chris, why don't you come on up? This is Chris. So there was a number of people that got to interact with Chris last night, and even despite that, he decided to stick around for this morning. I know, Mark was there, and he still came back, Mark. I don't know what's going on. Yeah, you tried. You tried real hard, I saw. Anyway, so Chris is going to share with us a little bit here, so let's just hear what Chris has to say.
Hey, good morning, Little Falls Alliance. My name is Chris Secor, and thank you for allowing my family to come up here and candidate with you this weekend. I want to start off real quick with a brief verse from Ephesians. Furthermore, because we are united with Christ, we have received an inheritance from God. For he chose us in advance, and he makes everything work out according to his plan. So, as Ryan said, I have a heart for youth ministry, and the reality of it is, every single one of us, whether you are a student or an adult, desires to have purpose and desires to belong. And there is a growing trend that frightens me to my bones, that people don't realize and understand you have purpose and you, in fact, do belong. And far too often, we see the consequences of that take place daily, whether it's in our schools or in our workplaces. And my heart for ministry came when I was 16 years old, and I attended a Life conference, and I believe a couple of our high schoolers are going to Life this year. And it was at Life I understood that my purpose was to be a follower of Christ and that I belong to Jesus Christ. And my purpose in that capacity was to serve youth and come alongside students and their families. Because I have a genuine desire that I want students and their families to realize you, in fact, do have purpose. You, in fact, do belong. Because far too often, as I said, the consequences of not believing you have purpose and not belonging takes much to weigh. And I want to change that culture. I want to change that trend. And I believe that if we invest in this next generation, and Scripture is clear that we invest in the next generation, the generations to come afterwards are going to follow the Lord wholeheartedly. I believe that we as a church family, we can do that with our students. We can change the trend that you, in fact, do belong, that you, in fact, do have purpose, and you don't have to listen to the lie that you don't belong and have purpose. And Jesus himself was so clear with this with the 12 disciples that he took under his wings. And Peter and the apostles were so clear with this with the people that they came across throughout the stories in the New Testament, that you have purpose, you belong. So, Lord willing, if I'm hired here with you guys, you know, if I get to do ministry along Ryan and along the students, along the families here, man, I just want to be invested in your lives, be invested with your family so that people can know, follow, and become like Jesus Christ. Thank you, guys.
Chris and Paige following the service this morning. We will have them engage with us through a format of question and answer. And so we want to invite and encourage all of the congregation to stay and to interact. What I do ask is, well, I want to be able to present them some of these questions ahead of time. They've already gotten some questions that people have submitted that they'd like to have some more information on. But I'd like it so after, don't do this during the service because that's so distracting. Right, so we'll do that in between time, if you will, all right? So if you have some questions that you would like to have Chris and Paige engage with, I just ask that you write it down, turn it into me before the 11 o'clock time where the adults and teens would engage with Chris and Paige in that question and answer format so that I can have a chance to show it to them ahead of time so they can be a little bit prepared for it. That's all I ask, okay? Any question is really free game unless it's, you know, Dan Jennings that's asking the question because we all know he has no questions worth asking, okay? Anyway, I haven't made fun of Dan in way too long. So that's where I want to encourage you to stay with that. I want to encourage you to engage with that because obviously most of you have just had, you know, 3 to 5 minutes to hear Chris's heart. And I think there's a lot more there than just 3 to 5 minutes worth. There was a number of people last night that were able to engage with them as a couple. And it just was, we did have a fabulous time. So please consider staying and hear the heart that Chris and Paige have for ministry and for the Lord. I'd like to enter in this morning now as we look at the scriptures, as we look at what God has for us. In Isaiah chapter 6, we get this picture. Isaiah was a prophet, and in this time, we have this commission that the Lord presents to him. In Isaiah chapter 6, so it was in the year that King Uzziah died, this is verse 1. It says, I saw the Lord, this is Isaiah, he sees this vision, he says, I saw the Lord seated on a throne high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him, there were seraphs, each with six wings, and with two wings they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. And at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Woe to me, I cried. This is Isaiah talking. Woe to me, I cried. I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. And then in verse 6, then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from the tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth, and he said, See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for. Recently, our family, Sarah and I in particular, have been trying to repaint the inside of our home. You know how it is. Okay, so you get a home and you paint up the walls a certain color. But we've been in this home now for since 2002, so well over 10 years, and things start to get a little bit in need of repair. You know, there's chips in the wall. We have this one spot. It's about this big. I know exactly what it's from. It's from the head of my son Isaac, who ran his head into the wall. It's perfectly round because he has a perfectly round head. As he was a young boy, he was bald, and we called him Charlie Brown. For Halloween one time, we even dressed him up as Charlie Brown. We sent him out trick-or-treating. There it is. Hey, Chuck. Okay, we had this perfectly round spot. Well, we didn't patch that one up, but we patched other spots because that one was especially sentimental to us. Oh, look at this spot. But we've been repainting the interior of our home. And now, because of the layout of our home, we have... If you've been to our house, it's a split level. And so oftentimes, most of these split levels, you have a pretty open upstairs. And so we have the one dining room area, which we repainted first because, as you know, we were dealing with all the rot on the outside of our house. And when you're dealing with rot and you're frustrated and you're using the Sawzall, sometimes the Sawzall gets away from you and you cut through the inside of the house when you're supposed to be cutting through the outside of the house. You know, it's one of those things. You know, and sometimes you hear the question, what does it take... that's enough to make a preacher swear? I didn't, okay. But I probably wasn't using, I wasn't happy. Okay, so anyway, you're cutting through the stuff and you cut through the wall on the inside. And it's like, what's this? Well, that's a mistake. So we painted that wall first. We did that one. But anyway, so the rest of it, so the split level, what we have is we have coming up the stairs and we have going down the stairs. And then the coming up the stairs, it goes all the way up to this vaulted ceiling and then spreads over and covers these two major walls. That's a big project. And it's a big project to do all at once. And so we've decided to break it down into pieces, something that's manageable. And what we did then is we started with the steps. It's just terrible. Young children are unclean, okay? I know. So they come in the house and they enter into the entryway and it's just, you can see their uncleanness just wash up the stairs. It's just filthy. And so we spent time and, Sarah, we had to wash the walls before you paint them because we were afraid there was so much grease and junk on the walls that the paint would fall off, And so we actually washed the walls first and then we painted, but we did it in sections. And so we did the steps first. And when we did the steps, we hadn't done the rest of the entryway or the other side of the steps. It was fascinating. Because you had this contrast. You had this newness that had just been cleaned and painted. And it was right next to you, literally bordering this area that hadn't been painted yet. And you could just see, wow, look at the difference. And I think that's what we're encountering here with Isaiah. Whereas Isaiah, and we'll get into this a little bit more as we go on this morning, but you have Isaiah, who is a man of God. He's a prophet of God. Clean, relatively. He comes into this interaction, this face-to-face with God, and suddenly there's a difference. There's something that is, wow, now that is newly painted. That is unclean. And Isaiah recognizes himself for who he is in that state, being confronted with God in that way. And he sees himself as unclean, and he says, woe to me. And his words are, I am ruined. Just like the walls of our house look to be ruined, Isaiah says, I am ruined. So we encounter the Israelites. You remember, as we've been working through, we've been dealing with this book of Exodus, Genesis and then Exodus. And so we're working through it, and we found that the Israelites have made their way to the base of Mount Sinai. And they have spent basically about a year, just shy of a year, at this base of Mount Sinai. And as they've been here, we saw how God descended on the mountain in this cloud, and he speaks to them, and he gives them these Ten Commandments. And he lays out just this is who I am, and this is who I have called you guys to be. You are to be my treasured possession, my holy nation, my royal priesthood. Okay, or my kingdom of priests, as it says in Exodus. And we find that at this moment then, so Moses goes up because he's called up onto the mountain, and he comes down with his Ten Commandments. So in the midst of God giving this instruction, Moses comes down and he finds what the Israelites have done in his absence and how they have created for themselves this golden calf. And he breaks the tablets, and he grinds up the calf, and he makes the Israelites drink the golden calf. And then we see how God took and he comforted Moses and he comforted his people even after that. We dealt with that last week. Even after their sin, he draws them to himself, even in his anger, draws them to himself and offers this, I am your Lord. I will go with you into the land of Canaan. We see this intimate, intimate interaction. And then what happens is God calls Moses then up into the mountain again, and he passes by and allows Moses to see all of his glory, but he shields him from it so he doesn't, you know, isn't killed with his amazing holiness and glory. And then he says, Moses, what I need you to do is chisel out for me some new tablets. And then God writes on the new tablets. Moses did the work of chiseling it out, but God is the one that does the writing on it. And then we see all of this kind of come into fruition. And we looked at what the passage that's been our theme for the last few weeks. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, God says, I got everything. You specifically will be my treasured possession. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And this morning, I want us to look particularly at this idea of a holy nation. And we find then, as we move through, what goes on is we have all of these rules, all of these regulations that God had given to Moses while he was up on the mountain. The Israelites spend the next year while they are there at the base of Mount Sinai making these things. They're making the Ark of the Covenant that God had instructed them to make, making this altar of incense, and creating this table for this tabernacle, and creating the tabernacle themselves. So he spent all this time to do and fulfilling what God had called them to do. And then we see verses like this in Leviticus 19, where God says, speak to the entire assembly of Israel, and say to them, be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. This doesn't make sense. This is a people, this is a stiff-necked people that God had just called them stiff-necked. You have defiled me. You have created this idol. You have not worshiped me. You have sought your own stuff, and I am bringing a punishment on you. He does all of this. They do all this nasty stuff and throwing it in God's face, and yet God says, to me you will be my holy nation. And not only that, I need you to be holy because I am holy. Bottom line, it's too late. They've already messed up. It's too late. And yet we find Leviticus 19, which was given after this incident that we find in Exodus 32. And it's a paradox that we're going to find. This fact that God calls his people to be holy as I am holy. I shared it in my email this past week. We were sitting at the supper table, and the children were asking, can you go a day without sinning? You know, and then flat out we said, no. You know, you just can't do it. And Isaac says, this is our son, he says, I'm going to try. I'm gonna do this. He said, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna go a day without sinning. And my wife then says to him, and maybe you read the email, my wife says to him, well, you do realize that this means that you're gonna have to be, you know, kind, good, great to your sisters. He says, oh man, I'm done. You know, that's it. That's it, it's over. I lasted, I'm pretty sure it was about 15 seconds just right now. But there's this reality, and we don't really, you know, this is something to wrestle with. This idea of, it says, be holy as I am holy. I can't do it. You know, my pursuit of holiness lands empty. I can do all that I want to do to try to strive and do right, and it's not working because I recognize the fact that I'm not holy. Just like Isaac recognized before he even tried, I can't do that. Impossible. And he's right, it is totally impossible. If he could go an hour be kind to his sisters, that wouldn't be possible. But here we have this idea, we have this God who is different. We have this God who is indescribable. As soon as we try to describe who God is, it already lands foul because there are no words that articulate who this God really is. You know, we can say God is a consuming fire, and that's true. That is accurate. However, it is not all-encompassing, and so it falls short in describing him, and thus it's inadequate in describing God. So if someone asks you the question, you know, how would you describe God? Well, then he's, yeah, but he, there's just nothing that really describes who this God is. We use imperfect language to try, but it falls short because he is so separate. He is so different from anything that we can describe, and that makes him, he is then holy. The idea of holiness is this separation. It's this setting apart, but God is holy. We saw it in Isaiah 6. It said, holy, 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 three times. In other words, it's like, it could have just said God is holy, but it's actually saying that God's holiness is holy. God's holy, holy, holy. I mean, it's just that much removed from anything that we really grasp and comprehend. It's above and beyond. You can't really fully comprehend how holy this God is. And it's interesting. We go through our lives, despite the fact that we can't describe him, we try to live our lives as holy, especially if we're followers of Christ. We have been trained. We default to this works idea, and we have been trained to try to do the right thing. We've been trying to earn God's acceptance. We say, oh, it's not by works. I know we say it all the time. But we default back to, if I do the right thing, then I will be accepted. But as soon as I mess up, I'm in trouble. And what's fascinating is, sometimes in our pursuit of holiness, trying to do all the right things, we find ourselves not looking anything like the world. You know what I'm saying? Okay, I'm living my life different than the world. And so I don't look anything like the world, yet I don't even look like God. Because I'm so focused on doing this and this and following these rules, I may not look like the world, but I don't look anything like God does either. And we find ourselves in this paradox. What in the world? How do I handle this reality that says, because I am holy, or you are to be holy? I think we need to stop looking at ourselves in this and start looking towards God. Because when I look at myself and I care about my image and I care about this is what it looks like to be holy, then I look in the mirror and I say, wow, I look holy. Look at this. Huh? Now that, my friends, is holy. And as soon as I do that, I just totally miss out on the picture. It's not reflecting God's image at all. It's reflecting my image. We talked about that several weeks ago. And that's what we try to do. We try to make our image to reflect something holy, but we can't do it. And we're going to see that this morning. Think of it this way. Think of a believer in Jesus Christ spending his whole life striving to do the right thing. And how that person could be further from God than someone who just spent their whole life distant from God and just comes to realize that their own need for him. Do you see that? You could be a follower of Christ. You could be a believer, I should say, in Jesus Christ your whole life, striving to follow the rules and be more distant from God than someone who has spent their whole life being distant from God and suddenly coming to realize, I need him. And that moment that they choose, yes, I need Jesus, despite the fact you got this person over here who spent their whole life at it, they might be closer to God than this person who spent their whole life trying to do the right thing. And there's something there that we need to grasp and catch this morning. But is this what God's calling us to do? To do everything right, to do nothing wrong, so that we can feel distant from God? And so that if we do all these right things and we try not to do these wrong things, that we can feel guilty of our mistakes when we do mess up? Is that what God's calling us to do? So that we can feel distant and guilty? I think, in other words, God, you know, I want you, is he really saying, I want you to work and work and work? I don't want you to do anything wrong, but I want you to do all this stuff so that you can feel frustrated and hopeless and distant and far from me. And I don't think that's what God wants for us. I think he's got something better in mind. And we're going to see that as we move on. Because God has a desire to dwell with his people. And I think that's such the key that we're looking at here, is that God desires to dwell with his people. How can a holy God dwell with a stiff-necked people? You know, that's the paradox that we exist in. And so we find that back in this book of Leviticus, we find that how can this God, this holy God, dwell with a stiff-necked people? He provides this idea, this sacrificial system. And it's a step-by-step so that you can approach him. And I think I got, I think, pictures? Yes, here it is. So this was the idea. God implements this system, and the idea of it is, yes, we have the sacrificial system. We have these different washings that are intended to be able to present ourselves in such a way, ritually clean, maybe morally clean, but there was these certain things that they would want to follow that would allow them then to approach God, to get closer to God. And what's fascinating is this, the Holy of Holies, is where God would have dwelt. And the whole idea of the systems, the sacrificial system, was so that they could enter in here, all right? They had the sacrifice of confession. They had this ritual washing. They could enter into worship. They could only go so far because only certain people had the authority to be able to be clean in such a way, because they were priests, to be able to enter into the Holy of Holies. But you see what this is going on here. So as they would do the sacrifice, as they would do their ritual washing, as they would enter into worship, where are they going? Closer and closer to God. And the closer they got to God, the closer they became to holiness. You follow that? Because where does holiness exist? Right there in the Holy of Holies. And the whole purpose and the point of the sacrificial system was to engage the people to be able to get closer to God. And so he lays this out, and it was this progress. And yet what we find then is in this tabernacle, this is a picture of the tabernacle. It's not real. They didn't have cameras. Okay, this is made up. This is what someone thought it was. But this is what you have. You have, okay, these are some of the items that were told to be created. So they made them. This is what God told Moses to make. They're aspects of their worship. So they would enter in, and as they got closer, they would get it closer to God's holiness, they get closer to God's presence. But this was a curtain that was existed there. They couldn't pass that. That kind of veiled God's holiness. Similar to how God veiled Moses and so he couldn't see him, there, you couldn't get into his full holiness because it would just consume you. But yet you could approach him to a level and have worship, and you could have that, the connection, the nearness to God. So what do we do with this reality? Okay, we can't do it. I mean, as I go in there, I recognize my uncleanness. Yeah, I can do some ceremonial washings, but does that really make me any holier? Not really. It's following some of these ritualistic rules. It's certainly following God's plan to be able to draw near to him. But there's got to be something more. There's got to be something different. Something that, I wouldn't say that we're missing, but there's something that we can only do so much. And that's where he steps in. And this is in the book of Leviticus. This is in the book of the law. This is in the book of the sacrificial system. Leviticus 20. We find that this phrase, okay, the one, be holy as I am holy, or some form of it, we find that through Leviticus 11, and it's repeated in 19 and 20 and 21 and 22. It's repeated and repeated and repeated throughout the book of Leviticus. This is an important piece that God keeps laying out to them, even in the midst of understanding all these sacrifices and rules. He's laying it all out, and he says, be holy as I am holy. But this, catch the language change in verse, or chapter 20, verse 7 and 8 here. Consecrate yourselves. Okay, consecrate would be like that separation, okay? Separate. Set yourselves aside for what I have for you. Set yourselves aside and be holy. We just said that. Because I am the Lord your God. Keep my decrees and follow them. Here it is. Bingo. I am the Lord who makes you holy. Do you have any idea how huge that statement, that piece of that sentence is? I am the Lord who makes you holy. Our culture, our churches emphasize this reality. Well, you do this, you don't do that, you do this, you don't do that. Yep, there's some value to that. I don't disagree with that. But we're missing this idea of who it is that's doing the work to make us holy. Because if I am the one striving to do this, do this, do this, and follow all those rules so that I can look into this mirror and say, wow, now that is one handsome, holy guy, I have totally missed what God is doing. Because that's my image I'm reflecting, not his. And we are called to do what? Reflect his image. And when I do the work and reflect my image, it's doing nothing to edify his church. But when I allow him to do his work and reflect his image, wow, is that not something special? Look at these others. Leviticus, again, chapter 20, verse 25, it says, you must therefore make a distinction between clean and unclean animals. And between, so here's the deal, and let me preface this before we continue. The idea was there were certain things that if you touched them, the uncleanness of them would be put onto you. You would then carry it with you, okay? I'll tell you more stories about that, but that was the idea. So you couldn't touch even unclean things because that would contaminate you. All right, so you must therefore make a distinction between clean and unclean animals and between unclean and clean birds. Do not defile yourself by any animal or bird or anything that moves along the ground. Those that I have set apart as unclean for you, you are to be holy to me because I, the Lord, am holy and I have set you apart from the nations to be my own. I'm calling you to be something different. I'm setting you apart. Sanctifying, these are all words that really tie into the same idea of you have been set aside for me and my purposes. You are my people. Despite the fact that the whole earth is mine, you are my treasured possession. Here it is. You are to be my own. Leviticus 21, regard them as holy. This is talking about the priests. However, the rules of the priests were the same as the rules of the people. The difference was the consequences that would come on the priests if they disobeyed the rules. If all the call is the same, sometimes we think that, oh, that was just a call for the priests. That's really not the case. The call was for all of the Israelites had the same set of rules that they must adhere to. Now, the priests had certain allowances to be able to head into the Holy of Holies at certain, you know, ritualistic times. I understand that. But the rules by which to approach God were the same, whether you were a priest or whether you were just one of the other Israelite people. So they are the same. Regard them as holy, but this is talking to the priests specifically, because they offer up the food of your God. Consider them holy, because I, the Lord, am holy. Here it is. I, who make you holy. Who's doing the work? And here it is, Leviticus 22. The priests are to perform my service in such a way that they do not become guilty and die for treating it with contempt. I am the Lord who makes them holy. You seeing the pattern? That's right. Keep my commands and follow them. I am the Lord. Do not profane my holy name, for I must be acknowledged as holy by the Israelites. I am the Lord who made you holy and who brought you out of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. So here's the deal. This passage that I read in Isaiah, you got to remember, Isaiah knew Leviticus. He knew the law. As a prophet of God, he was aware of it. And yet he has this vision, and here he is. He's thrown into this throne room in his vision, and he comes to realize, I shouldn't be here. I have no business being here. Because now I am suddenly thrown into this holiness of God, this presence of God, and his words are very descriptive and probably very accurate. And he says, I am ruined. meaning I got nothing here, because suddenly I, who am a man of God, a prophet of God, am thrown into a situation where, whammo, this was my image. And I don't know that he was there thinking all arrogant of himself, but the reality of it is, okay, we have our image, but it looked nothing in comparison to the image that he was suddenly faced with. He's face to face with God, and he falls down and he says, I am ruined. And this is the most beautiful piece, and it's such a picture of what God does then. For Isaiah, an angel takes a coal. Does Isaiah go and do something? No, he's ruined, remember? Okay, he can't do anything. So an angel goes and takes the coal with some tongs. And the angel flies over to Isaiah and touches his lips with the coal. God does the work. And then the angel says, it's been atoned for. It's been taken care of. Yep, you were unclean, but God took care of it. Wow. Does that not just get your blood going? This reality that, oh man, I am ruined, I'm a mess. Yeah, here's God doing the work. And that's all it took, was a touch from him. In Ezekiel, we find this other vision where Ezekiel has this picture, this vision where he sees the temple of God, and outside of the temple of God, out from the threshold under the door, comes water. All right, there's this water coming from under the door. You know, if you're living in your home and you have this happening, this is probably not a vision. You should really call the plumber, okay? So we have this water coming out from under the threshold, and it grows. It starts small, and it gets deeper, and it gets bigger, and it gets wider. And it says at the very end, there's like a mile wide. And everything that this river touched flourished. Everything the river touched flourished. And what's interesting is they had this concept, even in Ezekiel's time, that they were to approach. They had to do these certain things to approach the temple, to approach the Holy of Holies. And we find two things happening, one in Isaiah's and one in Ezekiel's, where suddenly what was in the temple is coming out to the people. You have God with the angel touching Isaiah's lips, doing the work, and we have the river coming out of the temple. Okay, that's abnormal to what they would have understood of the temple. Everything would be preparing yourself to go in, and suddenly we have something coming out. And what comes out and what touches it, it just flourishes and blossoms. And then we think of Jesus and how Jesus lived his life, and he touched people. I think I have the passage here, I think. No, I don't. I'm going to read it to you. At least tell you about what it says. Mark chapter 7, verses 6 and 7. Jesus quotes Isaiah chapter 29. And what's going on here is you have the Pharisees are kind of saying to Jesus about his disciples. They're saying, you know, here are your disciples, and I'm noticing that they're not washing their hands before they eat. You know, that's, according to our traditions, that's against the rules. I mean, they're not even following our traditions. That's fascinating that they use the word tradition. Not God's command, but tradition. Anyway, they're not following their tradition. They're being unclean because they had not ceremoniously washed their hands before they eat. Seriously, Jesus, what's going on? And Jesus says, he says, the prophet Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, you hypocrites. Because you speak truth with your mouth, but your hearts are far from me. In other words, you have presented yourself where you look at this image like, wow, I look good, and yet you're not reflecting at all what God looks like. You don't look anything like him. Your hearts are far from him. Sometimes we feel like we need to wash before we approach Jesus. Sometimes we feel like we need to get ourselves right with the Lord before I can even go to him. And this is telling us the opposite. This is communicating to us the opposite. Jesus went and touched unclean people. We were working at a work project a number of years ago, my family, because we do ministry together a lot. Sometimes my kids like it, sometimes my kids don't like it. That's just a reality. We're doing ministry together, and I don't remember the circumstances, and they're probably going to bark up and say I got the story wrong, but from what I remember of the story, it was something like this. We were cleaning around Lindbergh Elementary School, And we're picking up garbage. We have garbage bags. And I think we even had some, you know, gloves on because you don't want to touch unclean things. You know, we're very much in favor of that. But we come across, I think Sarah was the one that came across this dead bird. And she screamed and did the bird dance is what it's kind of been known to. It's like, you know, it's dead. The hands go like this a little bit. You know, the voice goes, ah, okay. And it's just like, whoa, bird. And if I remember correctly, Isaac was pretty enamored with the dead bird. You know, a lot of boys are very enamored with dead things. And in fact, we were over at, a week and a half ago, over at someone's house. I'm not going to say who because I don't want to embarrass anyone except Dan Jennings. We were over at someone's house, and this person basically had squirrel problems, okay? And so they were, like, eliminating the squirrels so they weren't eating the bird feeders. I know, Pam. I'm so sorry, okay? Another reason. Pam is a animal lover, okay? I love animals, too, usually in my belly. Okay. Anyway. So they had a squirrel problem, and the squirrels would not leave their bird feeders, et cetera, alone. And so the matters were taken into birds, or animals died. Okay, without going into detail. And so they recruited Isaac to take care of the dead animals, which he just thrived in. It's like, wonderful, okay? But when he's done, all right, here's the thing. Yes, you had gloves on. You wash your hands. Because what you just touched, bacteria, seriously, wash your hands. Likewise, when Isaac was playing with the bird, wash your hands. It's dead. There's disease, what have you. And this is the difference. Is Jesus was willing to touch the people. And this is totally contrary to the belief system that the Pharisees would have had, because they would say, well, you don't touch those things because they will make you unclean. Jesus touched things and made them clean. Do you see that? Just like the water in Ezekiel's vision coming out of the temple, came out of the temple. God comes out of the temple and starts touching things and it's flourishing. Things become holy when God's presence rests upon it. When we look at this passage, be holy as I am holy, I can't do that. But God can, and he does do it, because where God's presence is, then it makes it holy. Like he said to the Israelites, be holy as I am holy. I am the one who makes you holy. He has done the work. And then we find a couple of New Testament passages. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, who is in you? God makes you holy. Whom you have received from God, you are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. And then 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. Therefore, with your minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance, but just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, be holy because I am holy. Can you imagine the reaction that the priests tending to the temple would have had when Christ died and that veil was torn from top to bottom? Suddenly this big no-no area, this I am not prepared for this, this holy of holies is ripped open and he's exposed to God's holiness. I love this picture because it looks like this guy's in just this huge panic. And rightly so, because everything that he's understood about God and his holiness needs to stay there. And yet what God is saying is, you know, my dwelling is with people. My dwelling will be with mankind. In Revelation, we get this beautiful picture near the end where God says, through John the Revelator, he says, my dwelling will be with man. There's no more need for a temple because his dwelling will be with mankind. Isn't that something? And you're holy when you accept Christ, when you choose to follow him, you accept him. You're holy, despite your lifestyle. And then, okay, so that doesn't mean that, all right, then I can do whatever I want. It's this idea of now we saw how we were pursuing God, and he pursues us. We draw near to him, he draws near to us. We approach him, he comes. He's opened. His holiness has been given to us. Becoming holy isn't pursuing, excuse me, being holy is pursuing God. pursuing Jesus and allowing him to create in you the new creation that only he can do.